And William McRaven is the most powerful figure in the United States military. He's an incredibly brilliant man. He's very shrewd. He understands media. And he is in charge of the most elite force the U.S. has ever produced. And he has been given carte blanche to do what he believes is right around the world, empowered much more under President Obama than they were under President Bush. In fact, you see someone who's worked within JSOC saying that to us in our film. And out of Camp Le Menier, which is in Djibouti, the U.S. has been expanding these covert wars in Africa. And most Americans know about Somalia is Black Hawk Down. And I think in a film you're going to see a very different reality, and you're going to see a hellscape that has been built by a decade of covert war.
Is it too cynical to say? I mean, this is the fourth anniversary of President Obama promising to close Guantanamo. It hasn't happened. There's still scores of men there, 166 men. Something more than 80 of them have been cleared, yet they're still there. Is it too cynical to say that this dirty war, as you call it, the targeted killings, are a way to end all of these prisons, because you don't detain the prisoners, you simply kill them?
Well, that's what people like Jack Goldsmith and other, you know, former Bush legal advisors and national security team. I mean, the irony of these guys who have no moral standing to talk about these issues are saying, well, Obama's just killing these people. At least we stuck them in some sort of a prison. I mean, it's devastating that this is what these Bush people are saying about Obama. That's what they're alleging.
Well, devastating is your film. Dirty Wars. The world is a battlefield. It is premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival. Has just been picked up by IFC Sundance Selects, which means it'll go out to scores of movie theaters around the country. This is just the beginning, and I congratulate you both, Jeremy Scahill, Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films and The Nation Magazine and Democracy Now! What an amazing film. This is our first day at Sundance Film Festival. I thank all for all the work they've done. Mike Burke, Renee Feld, Sarah Matte, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dennis Moynihan, Brenda Murad. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Bob Longman with the WUSB Concert Billboard for Tuesday, January 22nd. Johnny Winter will be at B.B. King's in Manhattan, 8 p.m. Anna Egger will be at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 1, Manhattan, at 8 p.m. Tim Chason, who was featured here at the University Cafe on Sunday, will be at the Living Room in Manhattan at 8 p.m. The City Cafe will host Noise in Garden City. The Metropolitan Room in Manhattan will be featuring Sharon Clarke and Anne Ross. Your concert billboard for Wednesday, January 23rd, Jesse Cook will be at the Bolton Center in Bayshore at 8 p.m. Stone Sour and Papa Roach will be at the Terminal 5 at 7 p.m. Live Art Fusion with Ken Talv Trio will be at the Hanu in Huntington Village at 7:30. Pete Kanellis will be at R.S. Jones in Merrick at 8 p.m. Mark Phillip will be at the Black and Blue in Huntington, at the Iridium in Manhattan, Hot Club of Detroit, and Serial Amy, who will be performing at 8 and 10. And at the Highline Ballroom in Manhattan, Jose James, 8 p.m. Your concert billboard for Thursday, January 24th, The English Beat will be at the Paramount in Huntington Village, 8 p.m. The Vigilance Committee, Motion Ocean, 10,000 Suns, and Phantom and the Fox will be at 89 North in Patchogue at 8 p.m. Big Daddy Kane will be at B.B. King's at 11 p.m. in Manhattan. The Gallery Z will feature In Circles Open Mic Night. That'll be music, art, comedy, poetry, etc. And that starts at 8 in Rocky Point. And Project Vibe will be at the Public House in Southampton at 8 p.m. This is your concert billboard for the beginning of the week. Check in at WUSB's website, WUSB.fm, and click on the concert billboard link on the far left. And you'll see if anything has changed since this broadcast and what's happening in weeks to come.
Are we
finally working. Good. You know, I don't understand it. Why? How hard is it to fix a wire? For years this has been going on. I'm sorry. Almost every time I turn on the microphone, it doesn't work. All right, 2 minutes after 6 o'clock, you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. I was in a good mood. I was in a good mood, and now this has to happen. All right, it's time once again for Off the Wall.
Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Do you like the theme? Yeah, we're trying it out. It seems to be working just fine. And of course, as is the history on this program, every time we get a new president, we change the theme. We skipped it the first time it happened. Well, we didn't actually get a new president, and we didn't this time either. But every time a president is sworn in, we change the theme. Sometimes ever so slightly, as in this case, and sometimes radically, as when Bush changed to Obama. So, yeah, it's something we do every 4 years. And, yeah, we do have a second term now for Obama. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the midst of all the crises and various other things going on both here and abroad. Sometimes a second term is better. Sometimes a second term is kind of pointless. I guess we'll see which way this goes. I remember being there 4 years ago. That was something. It was biting cold. It wasn't biting cold yesterday. It is today, though. At last, winter has finally hit us. -6 as I was leaving the house earlier. And, of course, that's -6 Celsius because I've got one of those clocks / thermometers that is Celsius and 24-hour. You can set pretty much any of them to do this. And it's not a bad idea to at least start thinking the way the rest of the world thinks. And the rest of the world tends to think in Celsius and 24-hour clocks, meters, things like that. So -6, I guess it's around 20 or so, something like that, 20 Fahrenheit. And tonight's going to get even lower. It might even have snow by the weekend, which would be great. But last year was awful because it barely got cold at all. We hardly had any snow. And one of the things that I want to do with this thermometer that I have is experiment a little bit. Right now it says -6. All right, and from what I can tell, from looking at the non-lit LCDs, it looks like it can hold two digits, with the third digit being only a 1. So if you have it in Fahrenheit mode and the temperature goes to 102, it'll display 102. Clearly, it can't display temperatures 200 and above. Okay, fine. Now, what I've noticed is that the dash for minus is what would be the middle part of the 8 in the tens column. So right now it says -6. What I want to know is what happens when it gets to a double-digit negative number. And that's what I was waiting all last winter to find out, because I don't see any place in that third column, in the hundreds column, for there to be a dash. And maybe there is a dash there. Maybe it's a very tiny dash. I don't know. But it has to hit -10 or more for me to find that out. This is how I live my life. I wonder about these things. And the other thing that I really wonder about, tonight is supposed to get down to 13 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just a little bit lower than -10 Celsius. I think it's -10.5, which is great. So I plan on staying up all night waiting for this to happen. And if it does happen, I'm going to take the clock and bring it outside. And the reason I'm going to do that is because there is also the inside temperature on the left-hand side, And there are clearly only two columns there. Apparently you can't be inside a house where it's 100 degrees or more Fahrenheit. I'm not about to try to test that out, but in this particular case, if I bring it outside and it's minus 10, and there are literally only two columns, where is that minus sign going to go? Or will it just say nothing? Or will it break? I don't know. I have to find out. Yeah, this is how I live. And also 24-hour clocks, yeah, they're a lot cooler, you know, because it's easier to know exactly what time it is. You know, usually you can tell if it's daytime or nighttime, but sometimes there's that period around 6, 7 o'clock where it's kind of light and you're not sure, what did I just sleep through a day or am I just waking? I don't know. Long nights, sometimes you get confused. So it's good to know 1800 hours, that's 6 p.m. 19, 7. You know, you can train yourself very easily to do this. And in the military, you have to train yourself to do that. Because that's the only way they... Well, actually, what's this zero dark 30 nonsense? What's that all about? What, they can't say 030? Like they're supposed to say? It's military time, for God's sake. They're going to invent another bit of time now? I'm sorry, but I can't accept that. Zero dark 30. That's the silliest thing I ever heard. The laughing stock of the world. But no, the 24-hour clock makes sense. It's something that all you have to do is add 12 to anything that's greater than 12. It couldn't be easier. If you know how to add, you can tell time. So, hey, it's 12 o'clock. That means it's noon. You don't add 12. It's after 12 o'clock. It's 1. Okay, you add 1 to 12, 1,300 hours. That's what you have. And it gets more complicated, I suppose, when it's 11:15 at night. Well, add 11 to 12. What do you get? 23:15. Not hard. You just have to start thinking in that style. And, you know, there never really was a push in this country to go for a 24-hour clock. And I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe it's because people are afraid that it'll be mandatory use everywhere. And, you know, that's not true. Even overseas, where they use 24-hour clocks, there are certain places they don't use 24-hour clocks. For instance, on clocks, round clocks, they don't have... Except for the stupid one I'm looking at right now in the studio, which for some reason has 24 positions. It literally looks like it's a quarter after 9 now, but it's actually a quarter after 18. You know, it's well-intentioned, I know, but it just looks confusing because a round clock is something that you look at where the hands are. You don't look at the numbers, at least I don't. That's how you tell the time. And that's one thing in most places, except for the WUSB control room, where you can tell at a glance what time it is, and you compensate. 10 p.m. It looks like 10 a.m. And I don't think anybody anywhere is going to be in the mood to hear a church tower chime 23 times when it's 11 p.m. So, yeah, there are these adjustments. But when you're telling somebody to meet you at 21:30, it's very clear. It's very clear. That's one thing we've never really pushed for here. It's a shame. In Quebec, they do this. Quebec, they have 24-hour clock for the most part. Ontario, not so much. The rest of Canada, not really. But in French Quebec, they do. And in most of Europe, they do as well. But the thing that we really lag behind in just about everywhere, except for, I think, one or two islands someplace, is the metric system. I don't get this. When I was a kid, we were converting to the metric system. What happened? Why did we stop? Actually, I know what happened. Reagan happened. That's the answer to a lot of things, actually. We've talked about this before, but Reagan tends to put the kibosh on a lot of things that are progressive and beyond the 20th century or even the 19th century. So, yeah, metric system was stopped dead in its tracks. Even here, years ago, back when we had money in this place, we had a thermometer. And the thermometer would tell you the temperature outside. Well, that's what thermometers do. Obviously, that's what a thermometer is for. So it told the temperature, and it also had a little button where you could switch between Fahrenheit and Celsius. And I was the program director back then, and I made a mandate, because you could do that. I said, From this point on, we will tell the temperature in Celsius. And we did. We did for years afterwards, until somebody decided to go back to Fahrenheit. But for those few years, we were the only station that would announce the temperature in Celsius. Yeah, it's currently 3 degrees outside, and people would freak out. They didn't know it was so cold. But they learned. They learned. And that's what you have to do sometimes, is teach people the hard way. But no, we went back to Fahrenheit, and then somebody took the thermometer, and we haven't told the temperature since. Well, I'd just like to know, what possible good does it do this country to remain in a system that nobody else uses, other than to isolate us? And I have to wonder, is that the reason? Is that what's going on here? Doesn't seem right. And it's so easy to make the switch in so many ways. You know, there a few years ago, I believe Pennsylvania Turnpike, they renumbered all their exits. Perfect opportunity for them to number the exits based on kilometers rather than miles. Wouldn't have affected anybody if they didn't want to learn kilometers. All they would know is the exit number. But instead, they went with the old-fashioned system. Little things like that can make a difference, because then you can say, look how far it is from this exit to the next exit. You already know the metric system. It's not hard to do these things, but there has to be a will. And I'd like to know, is it just laziness? Is it resentment at the rest of the world? Is there some particular reason why we like the old-fashioned system? I mean, I understand the old-fashioned system. Don't get me wrong. It makes a degree of sense. Because 0 degrees Fahrenheit is too damn cold, and 100 Fahrenheit is too damn hot. That is basically what it's all about. And Celsius, 0 is freezing, and 100 is boiling. So they each indicate different things. But it makes more sense scientifically, and if you see a scientist someday and ask them, they will say that they use the metric system. And all kinds of other hardware and measuring tools of various sorts, mechanics, all kinds of people are torn between the two systems. And it holds us back. Holds us back in so many ways. I was not planning on talking about this at all. But I sort of got got into it when I looked at the temperature on the way out and saw that it was lower than it's been this year so far. And hopefully it'll get to minus 10 and I can see what happens. See what happens to that that thermometer. You know, the new German car I have, I'm trying to figure out how to convert things there as well. I figure there should be a way, because there's a thermometer that shows up, but it's in Fahrenheit. I want it to show up in Celsius. It's a German car. It shouldn't be hard to do. The clock. I want the clock to be a 24-hour clock. I'm told that's impossible. You can only have the 12-hour clock. It doesn't even say AM or PM. So in those misty hours where I'm not sure if it's daytime or nighttime and its light looks about the same, I won't know. I'll have to turn on the radio or something and hope that somebody tells the time and indicates AM or PM. That the clock just says 12-hour format, but no AM or PM. So that has to be possible. Has to be possible to convert that to 24-hour clock. Has to be possible. Same thing with cable boxes. You know, cable boxes now are just big clocks, or most of them are. But they're all 12-hour. I want mine to be 24-hour. I do. It's distracting. It's distracting to see the wrong format, the format you don't want. We should have these options. And if we did have these options, I think we'd use them more and learn more. But, the smart car came from Canada, so that already has metric all throughout it. Unfortunately, it doesn't work at the moment. But I'm trying to figure out the with the new car, it has kilometers and miles. Of course, the miles are much more predominant than the kilometers on the dashboard, but at least they're there. But the thing that I'm noticing, or I'm suspecting, is that the odometer is off a bit. Actually, maybe not the odometer. Maybe it's just the speedometer, but of course they're linked together. Because the numbers that I've been seeing are just too fantastic to believe. I'm over 600 miles in a tank before I have to refill it. I'm not used to that. I'm used to something like 200 or 300. That's incredible. But also, when I'm traveling, I seem to be going a lot faster than I feel like I'm going. I look at the speedometer. Wow, I'm doing 80 miles an hour on the Long Island Expressway, but everyone else is doing the same speed. Is that possible? Is that what's going on out there? Or maybe my speedometer is off. So, you know, I'm trying to test these things out. You ever try to count mile markers while you're driving? It's not easy to do. It's not, you have to pick up some stranger and have them do it and believe them. The only thing I can find that works are those little those signs that they put up outside of schools that tell you how fast you're going. I've been using those to clock my speed. And I basically I went by at 20 and noticed that it said 19. I went by at 30, noticed that it said 27. Then I have to increase the speed and see if actually it gets less and less. And don't worry, I only do this during school hours because that's when people are in school. So obviously it's the safest time to speed past schools. And it just seems like it's off by a little bit. I don't think those signs would underestimate. I think they'd overestimate, if anything. So is this a thing? Is this a thing with new cars? Because think about it. If they made it seem like you're going faster than you're really going, your warranty expires a lot quicker. You'd think you were getting amazing gas mileage. And maybe you wouldn't speed because you'd think you were going faster than you really were, you know? So I've got to test all of this out and figure it out and compare. See, that's all I'm doing lately is just comparing different statistics and figures and things like that. All right. Enough about that. What's going on? Well, clearly we're not doing the UK show today. I didn't have a moment to put that together. And next week is another basketball game. Maybe we'll be able to do it for that. We'll see. We'll see what we can put together. It's no promises at this point. Just going through the news today, we have some things to talk about. I know that people aren't going to want me to talk about, but I'll get to that in due time. Something more cheerful. This is a horror story, actually. Apparently, jumping in front of subway trains is the latest craze. Happened today at Times Square around 10 a.m. Somebody was fatally struck, leaving bystanders both shocked and fascinated, according to the New York Times. Even as emergency workers struggled to remove the body, which was lodged beneath an Uptown No. 2 train, more than a dozen onlookers across the platform knelt, bent over, and laid flat on the cold concrete to snap photos with their phones and catch a glimpse of the victim. That's literally what people were doing. And you know, you heard that, didn't you? The board is falling apart again. This happened last week. This board is possessed. It's falling apart without me even touching it. All right, let me put that back. Sorry. So literally, in every moment, every waking moment, people just have their damn phones out trying to capture it and missing it while they're capturing it. I was watching the inauguration yesterday, and did you see Joe Biden? He was running around like a track star. He was bounding back and forth, shaking people's hands. It was really cool to see, actually. That's what people should do in elected office. They should be required to do that. But we live in this crazy society now where everybody's afraid of each other. So you see it very rarely. But he was going back and forth, and he was, having the vice president charging at you and shaking your hand. It's a moment you want to remember. But these kids, I saw what they were doing. They were shaking his hand, but they were looking at their phone because they were capturing the moment on their phone. They weren't looking at the guy they were shaking hands with. They were looking at the guy through the screen of their phone. Watch the video. You'll see this. Everybody was doing the same thing. And that is how we're going through life now. We're not experiencing life. We're experiencing life through our phones and whatever other devices we're carrying with us. You go to a concert these days or a rally or anything historic, and you look at the audience. And the majority of them are cameramen now. They're just holding up cameras, trying to capture the whole thing because nobody else is going to do this. No one else is going to get that shot. So they basically sacrifice the experience in order to preserve it for an audience that will never see it. And I guarantee they're not even going to see it because why would they want to? It's going to look crappy for starters. And it's in their heads, hopefully, that, well, they saw it through the screen before anybody else did. They've already seen the video. So they maybe they need to impress other people with what happened to them or what happened to their phone. But odds are their friends have already seen it on YouTube from somebody else. So seriously, folks, put down the damn phones. I mean, you're missing out on everything. And sometimes your life as well, because you're not looking where you're going. But it's turning us into this this culture of gawkers, where we just simply throw everything to the wind and try to capture every moment, no matter how tasteless it may appear. I mean, someone just threw themselves to their death in front of a subway train, and you think the right thing to do is to hold your phone up to that. And it reminds me of that scene in Network. That's the right film, right? Where the guy has a heart attack or something and dies right there while he's giving the news. And all the camera can do is just pull back to get a better shot. Yeah. Let's start living life again. All right. Now, you knew we'd get to this. You knew this was going to happen at some point. But yeah, we have to talk about the elephant that's all over the place. And yeah, Obama announced his ideas, his plans last Wednesday. And nothing surprising. Nothing really that surprising to me. A ban on assault weapons and mandatory checks on anybody who buys a gun. I honestly can't imagine why anybody, gun owner or non-gun owner, would find that objectionable. But people do. And I'd like to dedicate the program, the rest of the program, not to the people that I disagree with, but rather to the people I agree with on this issue. Because you guys are the problem. Yeah, that's right. You guys are the problem. The people I disagree with, at least I understand them. I know where they're coming from. I don't agree with them. But they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And this last week, they went out, they protested. I can't imagine what they're protesting. I really can't. I don't know why people need to have all these assault weapons, but apparently they feel they should have those. Apparently they feel nobody should be checked so anybody can get weapons, because literally the things that Obama is calling for are so tame compared to most other places. So incredibly tame. I don't see how anybody could disagree. In fact, I've heard from many people and news sources that most people in the NRA agree to these things as well. Something like 74%. Now, I just read that, I think, on the Huffington Post, so I'm not sure how accurate that is. But it would surprise me, because it makes sense. And it doesn't affect anybody right now who has either a gun to protect themselves or goes hunting. Doesn't affect them. We're not talking about that. But no, the people that I agree with, where exactly are you? You know, I'm not seeing anything in as far as grassroots demonstrations, voices raised, people saying, look at us, we're here. Not seeing that. I'm seeing that from the other side. And all the polls indicate that other side is a minority. But they're a vocal minority, and that's how you get paid attention to, by being vocal. And this is something that our side just can't seem to get. They assume someone else is going to do it for them. They assume that, well, eventually we'll find our way, or they assume it's all going to fall apart, and then they can say, look, I told you so. And I get that a lot. I get that a lot from people on the left, people I tend to agree with, who almost seem to want things to get as bad as possible so they can say, wow, poor us, look at what happened. 8 years of Bush, and I saw that so many times. We had two wars, and the amount of protesting against them was so minuscule when you consider the atrocities that took place, the amount of people who died, the pointlessness of it all. And now you have this situation where everybody is infuriated. And there was a lot of talking in the first few weeks after Newtown, but since then, a lot of silence. And you know, I've heard comments. I've heard all kinds of comments. Here's one. I don't support Obama's plans because he's out there killing people with drones. So why should I support his plans to control firearms in this country? I cannot imagine being more stupid than this. You disagree with foreign policy, and because of that, you're going to just not agree with anything that would be a positive thing coming from the same person. I mean, this is basically kindergarten mentality here. Our country is basically designed to be violent. It's almost in the Constitution. In fact, it probably is in the Constitution somewhere. But what I mean by that is that we have a history. We have a history of a lot of violence, a lot of invasion, a lot of sticking our nose where it doesn't belong. And that's not going to change overnight. So no matter who you elect to be president, you're going to see the same basic values maintained. And this is also why it's so hard for us to get rid of our guns, because actually the authorities kind of like that. You know, violence in society, violent video games, violence in movies, and basically just violence overall. It's good fodder for the military. You know, all these people, they've got it in their system. They need a place to let it all out. And hell, we're going to go invade this country next week. Are you in? And so many people are. So, yeah, you know, that's why we basically have such a hard time making progress. Because it's in our nature as a nation. So that's not going to change. It's not going to change very quickly. And it's certainly not going to change if, when these few opportunities come our way, we turn our back and say, well, it's not perfect, so I'm not going to support it. Same thing with healthcare. Yeah, you know what? I wanted healthcare to be so much more than it is. But it's a step, and it would have been a lot more had those same people turned up in as many numbers as the vocal minority who, for whatever reason, were opposed to some sort of national health care like the rest of the world has. They were the ones that were listened to because they were the loudmouths. And again, they did exactly what they were supposed to do. The people who agree with me, they did not. We did not. And it's sad because when you basically stand on the sidelines and assume that someone else is going to take care of things, you lose. Because there are always going to be people that want something else more. If you yield to them, they will get it. And that's how it's been. You know, they had elections today in Israel, and this is another example of what I was talking about. Netanyahu's probably going to win, but, you know, even if he hadn't won, even do something militarily or try to prove to the public how anti-Palestinian they were. No, because this is what the vocal minority, or maybe it's the vocal majority over there, seems to want, and no matter what side gets elected, that is what they are going to deliver. That's a big change that has to occur that has not occurred yet. And changing our mentality as a militaristic nation, that's going to take a very long time. But we will never get there if we don't make the little steps along the way. Where one day we wake up and say, hey, we're a different nation now. We're not the same country we were 50 years ago. That's actually what happened on Election Day in 2012. I heard the Republicans saying it. This is not the same country that your father lived in. They said something to that effect. And yeah, you know, when gay marriage is getting voted in as something legal by the people, when you have minorities in Congress more so than ever, when you have marijuana being legalized by the people, you realize we're a different nation now. This couldn't have happened a few decades ago. Maybe 10 years ago, this couldn't have happened. And when you add all of that up, when these little changes happen, they turn into big changes. You can't get the big changes without the little changes. And that's something that I think too many of us have forgotten. We want the big changes. Of course, we all do. But without those big changes, we're not willing to show any support for the things that we do agree with. So my advice is start speaking, start shouting, start countering. Because if you don't, your voice won't count. And the people I disagree with will win, and they will have won legitimately. And to those people I disagree with, hey, keep saying what's on your mind. Because I'd be doing the same thing in your shoes. I just happen not to agree with you. But you're doing it right. And I hope that we take a lesson from that. You know, this nationwide, I think it was in all 50 states, it was on all the international news. Demonstrations against what Obama was saying. And I'm not quite sure I understand what the demonstrations were all about, to be honest, what they wanted. I couldn't quite get my head around that. But it made the news and everybody is aware of it. And the demonstration against having guns everywhere, where was that exactly? Yeah, you know, we could probably get more people into Washington, D.C. than went there yesterday to see Obama to simply turn up to voice our outrage if we only got up off our asses and did it. So really, it's up to us at this point. And we'll see where it goes. Hopefully people will become more active. And yeah, me too. Me too. But it's a collective thing, you know. Obviously, we can all act as individuals. We can all call our congresspeople. We can all write letters and try and get the word out as much as possible. But at some point, you know, when you feel like you're swimming upstream and tired of hearing yourself saying the same things over and over again, you start to lose enthusiasm. And that's when the people that disagree with you take advantage. All right, so let's look at what has been going on today. You know, I was thinking of starting a feature on this show called Tuesday Shootings because, well, you know, we talk about various shootings that have gone on, but there were just so many these days that I feel if I just isolated it to Tuesday, we'd have more of a chance of getting through the show. So that's an idea that's out there. We're going to try and sort that out somehow. But no, today, have you heard about this one? This was just happening as I was preparing today, and in Texas, at a community college in Houston. It seems now that these law-abiding, well-armed people are shooting each other. Yeah, that's apparently what has happened. Three people were wounded today at a Lone Star College campus. In the Houston area, when one man opened fire on another during an argument, and the two of them apparently were shooting back and forth at each other, and some bystanders were hit. An argument, yeah, and, you know, I'm sure we'll hear people say, you know, if only those bystanders had guns, this wouldn't have happened. But you know what? If these people hadn't had guns, it wouldn't have happened either. And I'll bet they're law-abiding people up until this moment. And yeah, it's not legal in Texas to have a gun on a campus, nor should it be. And this is more indication why it shouldn't be. But if the conversation gets hijacked, it'll turn into why weren't more people armed on this campus to prevent this kind of a thing. Well, you know, it doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. You know, when people are shot at, you're usually ambushed. It means you have a real advantage. It's not like one of those old Western duels where basically you take five steps and turn around and shoot at the same time. No, people who are out to do you harm don't tend to do that. They tend to shoot at you when you don't expect it. Which is why, no matter how well armed you are, if they have that element of surprise, they have the advantage. Same thing with home invasions. I hear people say that you're taking away my right to defend myself and my family. So, you know, your home gets invaded while you're all sitting around the dinner table. There's two scenarios here. Either you say, hold on a second, I'm going to run upstairs and get my revolver and show you guys a thing or two. Or you go to dinner armed. And then what happens when you have an argument with Junior or something? You know, you have a few too many. You get the scenarios that we keep hearing about. Just doesn't work that way. That's not life. If you feel your house is in danger, get an alarm system. Do you really live in a paranoid world where you think that calling the cops isn't going to result in something happening? That you have to take matters into your own hands all the time? Get a German Shepherd. They're very good at barking and scaring away intruders. If you really think that's going to happen. Home invasions are nasty things, but I've yet to hear of one that was thwarted. I've heard of ones that were made a lot worse by people with guns, where innocent people were hit in the crossfire. But if we live in a society where our doors are constantly being kicked in by criminals, that's a problem right there that needs to be dealt with. And, you know, that's the other thing that keeps getting brought up. If you take away people's guns, and again, this is not being said. This is something that's being conjured up. We're taking away, we being citizens demanding this, taking away assault weapons, and we're taking away the ability for anybody to get a weapon without any questions asked. Not quite the same thing as coming in and taking away people's guns, but that's how it's being portrayed. And it's leading to panic buying, and ask yourself who is benefiting from that panic buying. The gun manufacturers. You're being used as pawns. Because you're not getting any safer by doing this. You're throwing away money, you're getting yourself all riled up, and the people who are inciting the panic are making a ton of money. And that's why they're doing it. It's as simple as that. But the thing I hear from people is that you take away our guns and only the criminals will be able to get guns then. And, you know, last I checked, there are criminals in all parts of the world. Every country has criminals. Why then is it that in those countries, those hellholes like France and Germany and England and all these places that where people have had their right to guns not honored like it is over here, how come their doors aren't constantly being kicked in? How come they're not being shot all the time by all these criminals? Doesn't happen. Look at the percentages of people who die by gunfire in those countries, and it's so minuscule as to be laughable. Well, it's not laughable, but compared to what we do over here. So there has to be a correlation. There has to be some kind of a correlation between spreading them around like candy and high murder rates. All right, what else? This one didn't even make the news. I mean, it took a day, but it finally made the news. This kid in New Mexico fatally shot his parents and three younger siblings. I mean, years ago, this would have been on the news 24 hours. I had to dig for this. Simply incredible. And this happened, I believe, on Sunday, only a couple of days ago. Nobody's talking about the law-abiding citizen until he stopped being one. And I'm sure that his right to have a weapon would not have been debated either, even though he was only 15 years old. A records check indicated that the teen had never been involved with the juvenile justice system before being charged with killing five family members. No history of any emergency calls to the home in the recent past. and a military-style rifle had been used in the crime. This is kind of odd. The teen is being charged with only two counts of murder and three counts of child abuse resulting in death. Is that how it works over there? You shoot a kid and it's child abuse resulting in death, not murder? Talk about second-class citizens. So a real tragedy there, one of so many, and literally coming out of nowhere. Nobody saw the signs of this one. Apparently no mental health issues, just something snapped, and the tool was right there, so easy to use. Another five people have their lives ended. Six, if you count the guy who did this, who hopefully will not be walking around. And then you have incidents like this. You know, these stories, I couldn't write these myself. I really couldn't. Five separate people were injured in three different gun shows over the weekend. Yeah. It's, what do you expect, really? What do you expect when you have so many people who obviously aren't trained and you have this culture where this sort of thing is encouraged? What do you expect? Three in North Carolina, one in Indiana, one in Ohio. They were all injured after their weapons went off at gun shows on Saturday, all on the same day. The most casualties came at the Dixie Gun and Knife Show in Raleigh. I bet not many people were injured by knives over there. Attendees bolted with at least one woman wiping out in the frenetic scene. What does that mean? Just falling down, wiping out? That's really worthy of news? Thank you, CNN. Gunfire ran out at about 1 p.m. Police later explained that a 36-year-old man from Wilmington, North Carolina, was unfastening the case of his 12-gauge shotgun on a table near the show entrance when it accidentally discharged. He had planned to sell the shotgun at the show. The birdshot ended up injuring three people. One was a sheriff's deputy. Not too keen on that, I would imagine. A 54-year-old woman from Benson, North Carolina, was being treated for a wound to her right torso, and a 50-year-old man from Durham, North Carolina, was treated for an injured left hand. The chief of police said, I want to emphasize that this is an accident. And that prompted police to ban any private gun sales at the gun show for the remainder of the two-day show, which concluded on Sunday. And said that there wouldn't be any private gun sales on fairgrounds for the indefinite future. Gee whiz, welcome to enlightenment. You just proved why that's a good idea. And a person is in stable condition at a Northern Ohio hospital after being shot by his business partner at a gun show run by Conrad and Dowdle Productions. The original owner of the Taurus semi-automatic 9mm handgun used in the shooting brought the firearm into the show fully loaded. This is in despite of the policy of searches to make sure all guns are not loaded and rendered safe before others can handle them. Well, guess what? Doesn't work. The man who bought the gun told police that he took it out, then accidentally fired it. Authorities don't know who brought the loaded firearm into the gun show and sold it. No records. And in Indianapolis, a man walking out of the Indy 1500 gun and knife show shot himself in the hand as he was loading his .45 caliber semi-automatic firearm. So, yeah. Doesn't take a genius to know that if you live in a society with guns all over the place, you're going to have accidents, you're going to have massacres, you're going to have all kinds of incidents. It's not difficult. I'd like to read a piece from someone named Michael J. Tansey called It's the Guns, Stupid. Play on the Clinton campaign, It's the Economy, Stupid. Seems like a harsh statement, I know, but Sometimes you got to raise your voice. We have reason to be extraordinarily proud Americans this week because of the courage, determination, and hard work of President Obama and Vice President Biden. We have a set of ambitious legislative proposals and executive actions whose passage would go a long way toward toward removing military weaponry from our schools and street corners. Actually, schools wasn't in there. I'm sorry. Our street corners and rural areas. Despite vehement disagreement from 74% of their own membership, this is where I read this, by the way, the NRA leadership's despicable fear-mongering in the service of profits for gun manufacturers and retailers has not prevented the White House from taking on the bullies, not because it's politically expedient, but because it is the right thing to do and the right moment. The NRA's playbook of lying low for a week or so until emotions begin to dissipate, then slithering out self-righteously to deny accountability, discredit those who disagree, and deflect responsibility to the mentally ill, and an insufficient proliferation of good guy guns. It's simply not working. Not yet. Look around. Far from dissipating, the momentum is surging. Headline news on a daily basis. Generals Colin Powell and Stanley McChrystal, real wimps those two, issuing outraged statements that semi-automatic assault weapons, huge magazines, and Kevlar-piercing bullets belong nowhere but on the battlefield. New York State's lightning passage of unprecedented tough gun regulation with strong bipartisan support. In a post 3 days after Sandy Hook, I concluded by saying that although I wasn't holding my breath, this time feels different. It still does. But there is a problem. Although we should applaud the president's and vice president's intention to throw the kitchen sink at gun violence, there is a real danger in a lack of laser focus on sweeping bans of all assault weaponry. Video games, violent movies, even background checks, guards in schools, and gun show loopholes. Not one of those. Good point. Because I do believe that video games and violent movies, and this is culture where we glorify these kinds of things. That is a big problem. And, you know, we can all voluntarily stop. We can say, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to have movies where firing a gun is seen as a good thing. That's our choice. That's up to us. It can't be forced. But if we do that, and it's still all over the place, still easy for us to pick up and start shooting whenever we feel like, it's not going to make a bit of difference. So, yeah, it would be great to have that world, and we do need to move towards that. You know, it used to be cool to smoke. You know, people did that all the time on TV shows and in movies. Now, not so much. And there's no law against it. There's no law saying you can't smoke in a movie. It's just that people don't see it as cool anymore. And we need that same set of values to apply here. Anyway, the rest of that column is pretty interesting. I don't have time to finish it, but it's called It's the Gun Stupid from the Huffington Post. And we are going to close with a song that came out in 1979. And it was the result of one of the first of the school shootings. This one by a girl, Brenda Ann Spencer, who fired at children in a school playground at Grover Cleveland Elementary School in San Diego, killing two adults, injuring eight children, and one police officer. It was huge news back then. It wouldn't even make the paper today, probably. But it was huge back then, 1979. It was 1 year before Reagan. And her reasoning, I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day. And Bob Geldof of Boomtown Rats was inspired to write this song based on that horrific event, that callous statement. But the things that have happened since, I think, are so much more revealing about where we've gone as a culture, about how this wouldn't even rank anymore as a major event, as horrific injury, as something to be shocked at. The only thing that's unusual is that it was a female doing it this time, and that doesn't happen very often. But in this particular case, it was a real turning point. And imagine if a song was written every time there was a school shooting. I mean, it could be a whole format of radio stations that just do gun songs or just do horrible tragedy-type songs. Certainly enough material for that. Anyway, we're going to go out with that. You can write to us, otw at 2600.com. We'll see you next week. Stay tuned for Finn. It's Emmanuel for Off the Wall. Have a good night. We'll be right back.
kids. Finn with you. Finn's Revolution right here on WUSB Stony Brook until the 9 p.m. hour. Tonight, very special guest, activist and anarchist Carrie Kunin will be talking about the last May Day's protests in Seattle and how she is refusing to cooperate with the grand jury, plus tons and tons of cool music. Carrie in about 15 minutes.
Del carnaval frente a la soberana de esta fiesta internacional. Fantasías de colores, antifaz y capuchones. Se ve adornada mi tierra en este gran festival. Cumbia, danzas y comparsas vienen todos a festejar frente a la soberana, reina del carnaval, frente a la soberana de esta fiesta internacional.
Just as hard. Who hung his head? For- for the ladies or pretended he did.
He did, she did, he did, we did.
She loves you, she loves you, she loves you so hard. The one person to help you cannot. But Charlie is a sinner, tell me teacher. You put on your light and then you turn around. Silent machine light. In my age, you don't count a hair but a cup high. But you know some of us will see more than eye to eye. She loves you, she loves you, she loves you so hard. The one person to have you cannot. But Charlie is a sinner, tell me teacher. You put on your light and turn around. I put on your lightning tonight. Lie.
Yeah, that's right. Woods right here on WUSB Stony Brook. In a few minutes, activist, anarchist, Carrie Kinnane from the West Pacific Northwest will be speaking to her about her activities at the May Day Parade and other people's activities at the May Day Parade in Seattle last year, plus her current stand against the grand jury subpoena. So stay tuned just a couple of minutes, about 3 minutes from now, we'll be speaking to Carrie Kinnane right here on WUSB Stony Brook. That's right, the OC's right here on WUSB. Stony Brook Finns Revolution until the 9 p.m. hour. It's now 7:22 p.m. on this Tuesday evening. And good to be with you and happy you're listening. We're going to be speaking momentarily with, well, we do have on the line here and have a pre-record section of Carrie Kinnane, activist and grand jury resister. And we're going to get to her in just 1 second here.
Terry's been involved in a whole bunch of activities out there in the Pacific Northwest. And as they say, she's an active anarchist, and she has some interesting things to say in this little interview here. And I have to say, I'm very, very privileged to having had a chance to speak with her. So I think without further ado, I think we will bring up that interview that we pre-recorded, and we'll talk to Carrie Kinney and listen up, because there's some resistance happening in this country on all different levels. You know, you might want to learn a little bit about it, be informed. These are things you normally don't hear about, as we all know, in other media, in a positive or objective light. And we're going to spend a little time doing that right now. So let's get to it. We're lucky enough now to be speaking with activist anarchist Carrie Kinney. Carrie, welcome to Finn's Revolution on WUSB.
Thanks so much, Finn, for having me on the radio show. It's really good to have an opportunity to speak about the grand jury and how people are resisting it.
Yeah, for any of our listeners who may not know, can you sum up the principles of anarchism and how and why anarchists in the Pacific Northwest had come to be involved in last year's May Day protests, specifically in Seattle?
Anarchism is a political philosophy centered on the idea that society, without domination, is much better suited to foster well-being of its members. Anarchists are necessarily anti-capitalists because capitalism hinges on exploitation and economic division. We also oppose the concentration of power that we refer to as the state. The state is the various bodies of law, force, and control that seek to contain the possibilities of society and compel us to perpetuate capitalism in our lives. There are a lot of other types of social domination that anarchists will fight to abolish, such as racism and patriarchy, and all of these are deeply entwined with capitalism as well. As for May Day, it is, among other things, an anarchist holiday. It's a day to commemorate the militant labor struggle for the 8-hour workday and the anarchists who were murdered by the state and imprisoned for participating in that struggle. The story is that in Chicago, where the labor struggle was particularly militant, the police shortly after May 1st opened fire on a picket line and killed some of the picketers. And the following day, there was a demonstration called, and a bomb was thrown at the police line and killed an officer and wounded some others. And subsequently, the state tried 8 anarchists for murder, and regardless of whether or not they were at that demonstration, all 8 were sentenced to either death or life in prison. So we take May Day as a chance to remember these militant struggles and to inspire us to keep fighting. Fighting the state that wants us to be submissive or to be dead. And every year, in a lot of cities all over, there are demonstrations and festivities. And in Seattle, there was a call out for anarchists to come together and have a really big anti-capitalist march. So a lot of people answered the call and showed up in Seattle that day.
Carrie, can you tell us what you can about what the May Day protests last year were all about? And were other progressive groups involved besides the anarchist group? What were the goals of the protest as you understand them? And if you can, what was your involvement in the protests? Were you arrested and investigated? If so, how were you treated?
There were a lot of events scheduled for May Day in Seattle, some of them related to Occupy. And I can't really say much about the organizing of Seattle's May Day because I don't live there and I wasn't part of the organizing. I will say that in a lot of places, May Day demonstrations have become sort of placid and not having the same spirit of resistance to state control. They get permits and have peace police, and there's a lot of investment in making sure that law and order is. It was not permitted, and there was no leadership or expectations of abiding laws. As for my involvement, I was in Seattle at the Anti-Capitalist March on May Day. I thought it was a really glorious day for anarchists. I think we effectively disrupted the goings-on of downtown Seattle. I wasn't arrested or anything, but clearly I have somehow become involved in the investigation. But with a secret investigation, it's difficult to glean much of any information, so I don't know anything beyond that.
Well, you know, some people are appalled and disturbed when there's property damage, when anything like that occurs in these kinds of protests. What can you say regarding that?
I would say that property destruction is an important tactic in the fight against capitalism. I think it does a number of things that further the struggle against abstract and insurmountable. They are vulnerable to attack. I think also that when an institution which forcibly maintains power over us is targeted by property destruction, this will often resonate with people who experience the violence of that institution. It makes us feel less alone and less like victims. And that's important. I think property destruction has a good effect on the people who carry it out as well. Most people need to unlearn the submission that we are taught and need to show themselves that they have the capacity to act for their own liberation. I think that when people burn cop cars or break big windows or blockade a road, they're demonstrating to themselves that they have, there's a magnitude to their ability to resist. And I also think that the economic damage of property destruction can sometimes have an effect on the state or capital. It's not as though breaking windows is goal, but it is a tactic that people shouldn't just thoughtlessly cast aside as if it were the introduction of violence into the fight against the state instead of what it is, which is a response to endless state-sponsored violence. There's a lot of arguments that I think are really flawed against property destruction, and without one to specifically try and debunk, I would just extrapolate on this point. I guess that generally people are accustomed to experiencing and absorbing state violence as normal. There's a desensitization and blame shifting that goes on to justify state violence against.